From Washington, D.C., the American Broadcasting Company brings you Issues and Answers. With the answers to the critical international issues facing this country, the Secretary of State, the Honorable Dean Rusk. Secretary Rusk, here are the issues.
Is confusion and bickering undermining the war against the communists in Vietnam?
Is Red China going to attack Quemoy and Matsu?
Has there been any progress in getting the Berlin talks off dead center?
Are we getting ready to make new concessions to the Russians to get a nuclear test ban?
Now for the answers from the Secretary of State, recently returned from a 10-day trip to five European capitals. To explore the issues are ABC correspondent Bob Clark, and with the first question, ABC State Department correspondent John Scali.
Mr. Secretary, there are reports that the war to defeat the communists in Vietnam isn't going too well, that the American military advisors there are unhappy at alleged confusion in the command structure, and that things are not as they should be.
Mr. Scali, I've seen the reports in the last day or so to which you refer. I also recall during World War II that I served from a company commander of infantry all the way to war plans on the general staff, and know that you can get almost any story you want to out of a situation like this. The war in Vietnam is a dirty, untidy, a disagreeable war. But the main fact is that the Vietnamese army, armed forces, are on the initiative. They're out aggressively running down these guerrillas. The guerrilla incidents are dropping in number. There has been a considerable improvement in such things as command structure, mobility, supply, intelligence. All of the elements which are so important in this kind of guerrilla operation. Now, there always is more to be done. And undoubtedly, this kind of warfare is frustrating for those who are taking part in it, because the enemy is unseen. He strikes without warning or notice. And when you strike back at him, frequently he isn't there. But the important thing is that the South Vietnamese Army is taking the initiative, they're reducing the incidents, and I think they're on the move.
Then you don't see any evidence of confusion in command structure, which is hurting us?
Oh, I think there have been some important steps taken to eliminate some of the confusion that existed. I think the coordination between the support which we're giving to the South Vietnamese forces and the South Vietnamese command itself has to be worked on steadily. But I think these things are being ironed out under the very skillful direction of General Harkins and his men. And I'm confident that this is not the problem. The problem is the very nature of the guerrilla warfare itself.
Mr. Secretary, are you satisfied that South Vietnam's President Diem is doing enough to mobilize public support among his own people for this fight against the communists?
Well, I think he's been doing a great deal more than, say, a year ago or 2 years ago. But I think I would never, in a situation of this sort, be willing to use the word enough, because there's always more to be done. I think he's been making some very substantial headway in this. But it's the unfinished business that always ought to be our first concern. And it's the next step that ought to be at the top of our minds.
Now that the war is over in Laos, there's some fear that this will release some 10,000 communists to fight in North Vietnam. Are we doing anything to provide safeguards that this doesn't happen?
Well, under the tentative, the outline Geneva Agreement, which is now being worked on at the conference on Laos, there would be a specific undertaking that Laos would not itself be a pathway for supplies or guerrillas or leadership into any of the neighboring countries. This would be an obligation on the part of the Laotian government. The two co-chairmen would accept responsibilities for enforcing it. The International Control Commission would have obligations to keep an eye on it. And, of course, in South Vietnam itself, their intelligence and other means for determining whether or not this, in fact, is being carried out. I would say that if in fact any of these communist forces move through Laos or from Laos into South Vietnam, that would greatly exaggerate the crisis, and we would have a great deal to say and do about what would result from that situation. But it is not contemplated that this could occur under existing agreements.
Mr. Secretary, have you been able to determine whether Moscow or Beijing exerts the most influence on the Laotian communists and on the communists from North Vietnam?
No, I wouldn't be able to assess the relative influence of those two capitals on the situation. There have been moments when I've had the impression that perhaps they did not see every particular point in the same terms or see eye to eye on them, but I wouldn't try to say at this point which had the larger influence at the moment.
Mr. Secretary, on another Far East problem, as you well know, there's been a buildup of communist forces opposite Quemoy. Do we detect any sign that this could be a prelude to attack on either Quemoy or Matsu?
Well, it's always a little dangerous to try to say exactly what is in the mind of someone on the other side, on the mainland, for example. There seems to have been some reinforcement of the areas adjacent to Formosa. There are several possible explanations, including precautionary measures in view of some of the speeches and talk that has been coming out of Formosa, some of the disturbances which have been associated with food shortages and floods in that part of the country, some indication that perhaps the communist discipline in that area has not been as tight as they had expected it to be. I would think at the moment the indications do not point to a major attack on the offshore islands or on Formosa.
Mr. Secretary, we have said, of course, that we would defend Quemoy and Matsu against any attack that appeared to be an invasion of Formosa. Can you conceive of an attack on these two islands against the backdrop of the present military buildup that we would not regard as an attack on Formosa?
Well, I think that is a matter on which the President would have to make a judgment, and I would not myself want to speculate about the circumstances in which that judgment would be made. I think it would not be for me to go into that today.
Do you plan to fly to Geneva personally, Mr. Secretary, to sign the Laotian peace settlement, which seems to be in the process of being drafted?
Well, if there is a prompt and satisfactory settlement worked out there, there is some likelihood that the foreign ministers would come over very briefly for the purpose of signing the agreements. But that is still in the offing, and no final decision has been made on that.
Mr. Gromyko apparently will be there for the Soviet Union. Would you take advantage of his presence while there to discuss Berlin and perhaps disarmament?
I think that if Mr. Gromyko and I and other Western foreign ministers found ourselves in the same city, that we undoubtedly will have some talks on a good many subjects, including, for example, Berlin and disarmament.
Mr. Khrushchev, as you know, said this week that there has been some progress on Berlin. Do you agree that there has been?
Well, there have been a number of ideas exchanged back and forth between the West and the Soviet Union. I think perhaps the sense of immediate crisis has been put to one side in the interest of a sober discussion of the underlying issues. I think there are some questions, perhaps of a subsidiary character, on which it would not be too difficult to get agreement if there were agreement on the central issues. But our concern is that on the central issues of the vital interests of the West, that we have not made satisfactory progress. So I do not at the moment see what, in the jargon of our trade, we call a satisfactory basis for negotiation.
Mr. Secretary, you have said several times that we're in Berlin and we intend to stay. Does this mean that we would not negotiate any reduction in the Allied troop force in Berlin?
Oh, the question of the numbers of Allied forces in Berlin has never come up. And actually, I don't believe that is the issue, because the numbers that are there are relatively small. They have no overall military significance from the point of view of the very large number of Russian forces, for example, in East Germany. The issue is really the presence of the Western forces there and our position in West Berlin and access to it. So that the numbers of forces, I think, is not really a problem.
Well, do you think the Russians would regard it as progress toward a Berlin settlement if we would reduce the Allied armed strength in Berlin?
So that has not been any impression that I've had, and in any event, I don't believe that is a fruitful path to go down. I mean, I think the issue there is who is to be responsible, what the vital interests of the respective parties are, and we could not trade out things of that sort in any great detail.
Mr. Secretary, disarmament talks with the Soviets resume in Geneva in exactly 8 days. Do you see any real hope for progress until the Soviets carry out this series of atmospheric tests that they say they're preparing?
Well, I've seen their statements on this subject. I think that we ought to continue to work at this disarmament problem, beginning again today, just as we have over the last several months, to try to find out where we can make some advance. We don't believe ourselves that this is a matter that the Soviets will indefinitely brush aside, because they have a basic interest, as do the rest of us, in trying to find some way to bring this arms race to a close and begin to turn this arms race downward. Now we'll go back to Geneva to do our best to find any way in which we can get started on actual physical disarmament or any progress whatever on such an important thing as nuclear testing. One of the great problems thus far has been that the Soviet obsession with secrecy has made it very difficult to take any steps which would have the proper safeguard so that all signatories to any such agreements could be reasonably certain that the other side was carrying out the agreement. I think once we get across that kind of hurdle, then we might begin to make some real headway. But as far as we're concerned, we have been trying for months, indeed since March of last year, to make some headway in this. We've been trying right through our own test series. We'll continue to try and hope very much that some breakthrough will come at some stage when the common interests of both sides in limiting this arms race can be acknowledged and we can get some agreement on the basis of that.
The Defense Department made public a report yesterday which showed that a series of tests that we've conducted have made some important progress in better detecting underground nuclear explosions. Do you think that these continuing series of experiments, if they prove to be successful, could open up the way for us to reduce the amount of inspection and we believe necessary on Soviet soil?
Well, those tests, of course, have been of very great interest to us in the Department of State and in the Disarmament Agency. They are a result of very expensive and very elaborate efforts made to accomplish just what you've indicated, to find more effective ways of detecting testing. Now, the results of these tests have not been fully evaluated, and the possible developments out of these tests have not been looked at thoroughly. But that is being done with great urgency. But I want to emphasize that, so far as we can now tell, it is still not possible to do all of this from long distance instrumentation. Even under the best of the results that we've had so far, some control stations and some on-site inspection would in any event be required. Now, so long as the Soviet Union is saying adamantly no control posts and no on-site inspection, then we are still back where we were. But nevertheless, we think that if something could come out of these Vela tests in the way of instrumentation, which would give us assurance so that we could reduce the kind of inspection which would, in the first place, be expensive, and secondly, would cause irritation or nervousness in such fields as espionage, this would be a great advantage. But nevertheless, it still turns on whether the Soviet Union is willing to give reasonable assurances that any agreement is in fact being carried out.
You think that the Soviets really are afraid of, quote, espionage, unquote, that could be provided for under any inspection teams or detection stations? Or do you think it's an excuse for just saying no?
Well, in purely rational terms, I would think that this obsession with secrecy has been carried much too far. I mean, for example, in the last session of the Geneva Disarmament Conference, we and the British put to them control and inspection procedures which would involve having a look, international inspectors having a look at less than 1/2,000th of Soviet territory in any single year. Now, from the point of view of espionage, it seemed to us that this completely eliminated that problem. But nevertheless, Russia, and when I say Russia, I mean Russia historically, long before the communist revolution, seems to have had this obsession with secrecy with respect to the foreigner. And I can't say that this is not genuine on their side. All I can say is that I think we have done everything that is humanly possible to remove this problem from the conversation. I must say that I've been disappointed and even a little surprised that they were not able, in the interest of turning this arms race downward, to accept these minimum assurances of security that were in our latest proposals in Geneva.
On a different subject, Mr. Secretary, President Kennedy has created a lot of comment around the world this week with his 4th of July speech calling for a partnership with Europe. Can you give us some specifics as to what form this partnership may take?
Well, Mr. Clark, it's not easy for me at this point to add very much to the President's excellent July 4th speech or to what he said in his press conference last Thursday. I think the great historical trend here is toward North Atlantic solidarity. Now, insofar as next steps are concerned, the next step, as the President pointed out, is in Europe. The common market negotiations with the United Kingdom and some others, the determination by the Europeans as to what kind of Europe they want to organize. As far as we're concerned, we would welcome a Europe which is as unified and as solidified as the European traffic will bear, as they themselves can manage. The idea that we have some jealousy or some resistance or some resentment of the arrival on the world scene of a vigorous and strong and confident and self-assertive Europe is just nonsense. This has been an object of American policy since 1945. So the next chapter is to be written in Europe. Then when they make their own determinations about what kind of Europe they want for themselves, then we, within the framework of NATO and OECD and with trade negotiations, which we hope will be authorized under the President's proposals to the Congress, then we will talk out with the Europeans, that Europe, how we and they can work very closely together, because we have the same commitments. We're determined to work together. We have the same interests as far as other parts of the world are concerned. The President emphasized that this North Atlantic community, as we see it, is not a rich man's club, I think were the words he used. It was outward looking into all parts of the world, aid to underdeveloped countries, special relationships to countries all over the globe in the interest of this great free world of which we're a part. Now, we have existing machinery which will permit us to go a very long way toward building further the partnership between the United States and Western Europe. Again, NATO and OECD gives us a great latitude with full support of congressional and political leaders in the country. It's for the longer range to decide to consider whether there are still more formal steps which ought to be taken.
Mr. Secretary, do you think this automatically means that there will be a reduction in the amount of American leadership and influence that we can exert in the Western world?
Well, I think when you look back to, say, 1947 and 8, when we, who had been unscathed by and large by the war, were about the only free country that could move with great effect in many parts of the world, when we were in behind the Marshall Plan, when NATO defenses depended critically upon the United States, that period is fortunately not with us any longer. We've got strong partners, strong allies, those who can help carry these burdens. And this is something that we welcome. Now, in that sense, you see, the relative responsibilities of the United States may decline somewhat. But the total effect of this free world partnership will increase and grow. Now, it's so that, you see, you can't really put this just in terms of our national position. It is in our national interest that Europe take up the historical burden of the great story of freedom, which Europe has borne over the centuries with great effect, take it up and move it forward. We'll be with them moving it forward. And in this joint interest, we'll have an effect, I think, in the shaping of history that will make an enormous difference.
You think it's in our national interest, Mr. Secretary, that General de Gaulle is exerting his own strong views on many Western problems in Europe?
Oh, I think General de Gaulle has made a historic contribution to France and to the Western world in his in what he's done from 1943 onward, 1942 onward. I think it is important for him to speak out on the issues that he feels strongly about, because that is a part of the context within which this unified Europe will grow. And I think the joint communique, which he and Chancellor Adenauer put out after their meeting, showed that they are thinking in terms of a strong and vigorous Europe, in which Germany and France would, of course, play an important role. No, I think we are under great obligations to General de Gaulle.
Don't you think that General de Gaulle, to a degree, has succeeded in wresting the leadership of the Western world away from the United States, to a degree?
Oh, I wouldn't put it in those terms, because what is involved here really is how we in Europe best move together within the North Atlantic community. I think General de Gaulle recognizes the fundamental importance of the closest possible cooperation between the United States and Western Europe. And I've had no reason to think that there's any doubt in his mind about the fundamental importance of this great community solidarity.
Mr. Secretary, do you think it's possible that someday this Atlantic partnership might include the Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries? If I remember correctly, General de Gaulle has spoken of a union stretching from the Atlantic all the way to the Urals.
Well, General de Gaulle, I think, was speaking in perhaps long-range historical yes. terms on that point. If the Soviet Union, their leaders, should ever decide to give first priority to the national interests of Russia and to the deep and known interests of the Soviet, the Russian people, then over time, over decades, I think things could be worked out where there would be much more of a normal relation between East and West. But this is going to require some major decisions across the Iron Curtain and some basic changes in their system and their attitudes. So long as they are pursuing the basic doctrine of world revolution, so long as they're saying it is this kind of world rather than the world anticipated in the United Nations Charter, then there are the deepest divisions and there are deep crises ahead of us.
Is there a danger at the moment that we're moving in the other direction, that the common market is driving such dissident communist countries as Yugoslavia closer to Moscow?
Now, this would, I think, depend upon the basis on which the common market works out its trade relations with other countries. Unfortunately, for this present period, when the common market UK discussions are going forward, it isn't possible for them to say clearly and specifically what their attitude is going to be toward a number of other countries. But as we've made it clear in our discussions with the Congress in connection with the President Kennedy's trade proposals, we see our own negotiations with the common market moving in the direction of a common lowering of tariffs between that common market and our own common market on a most favored nations basis. We don't want Latin America, Japan, other countries to be squeezed out of the trading opportunities in these two great trading centers. And I would very much hope that some of these countries in Eastern and Southeastern Europe, such as Yugoslavia, Poland, would have easy and free access to trading relationships with the West, because there's no question about it at all that the peoples of those two countries have a deep affinity for Western ties, that they have a nostalgia toward a restoration of the great traditional ties with the Western civilization, and that it's all in the interest of the future of freedom for these doors to be kept open.
Mr. Secretary, we want to thank you very much for being with us today on Issues and Answers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Scally.